Welcome to Talk Poverty Radio on the We Act Radio Network and the Progressive Voices Network. I'm Rebecca Vallis.
And I'm Tracy Ross, and we're joined in studio by our good friend Alex Lawson, who's the Executive Director of Social Security Works.
And the owner of We Act Radio, we should mention.
Yes, the last time he was on, we came to the agreement that we are partners.
Yes.
We're not each other's bosses.
You say that like we haven't had that conversation
every single time he's on. We'd had a truce about it. You, I think, are still bickering about who's the boss.
It's not bickering.
It's a strategic partnership.
There you go.
That's what
it is. A healthy back and forth is what we have every single time. And it's the same back and forth, but I never really lose the fun in it.
That's true. And one other important thing to note is that Rebecca is working extra hard today. She couldn't even take a lunch break.
What are we talking about
today,
Tracy?
There's a reason why. We want Alex on all the time, but there's a reason why that we asked him in particular this week, and it's because President Obama came out in favor of Social Security expansion, which is a pretty big deal. Can you tell us exactly what he said, Alex?
I actually can't tell you.
Paraphrase. Yes. I didn't mean quote the man.
Would you stop making unreasonable asks of our guest, Tracy? We said in pre-interview.
No, I can't. But what I can do is say that in a speech yesterday, he laid out a very positive vision for America. An America that works, an America that works for the middle class. And in that, one of the very central planks was on retirement security, which is not new for the president. And he went through his old talking points on it about increased savings. But what was new was saying that, but pretending that the only thing that's wrong is that people don't know that they have to save for retirement is wrong. People do know it, but with low wages, et cetera, et cetera. And that's why Social Security is more important than ever and why we need to strengthen it. And all this is still old language. And he says strengthen it not only for the future of the program, which, again, is what he usually would say, and then brand new language where he said, but also increase benefits so that people can retire with dignity, so that current workers and future workers can retire with dignity. And that was, I mean, to me, and in policy, you somewhat have to be like a Kremlinologist. You literally watch for these very small things, and you're like, those are new words. And those new words, though, are very meaningful because in this case, President Obama has been a leader on many things, but in this case, he is a lagging indicator. He is basically the last mainstream Democratic power center to come on board of expansion. And so now it's literally, there's no question that this is the mainstream Democratic position now. Any Democrat who supports cutting Social Security is extremely fringe. And the reversal of that, as everyone in this room knows, is actually remarkable, that only six-ish years ago, it was completely the opposite, right? I was sitting there as the fringe saying we need to expand Social Security, the royal we. And on the other side, you had actually a solid amount of people who were agreeing with that. We know that benefits have to be cut. We just don't know by how much.
Well, and Alex, just to cut in, right? So we're having a conversation about sort of it's the inside the beltway discussion around this issue, right? When you look at polling, and you know this better than anyone, but when you look at polling about what Americans want when it comes to Social Security, it's incredibly clear, right? Mm-hmm. Across income levels, across party lines, across generations, Social Security is basically the only thing people can actually agree on.
That's what Pew found.
Right.
Pew literally found that. They did a study on the polarization of America. They said America is polarized except on Social Security.
Everyone loves it. Everyone doesn't want to cut it. And there's been increasing support over the last several years for the idea of actually expanding benefits and also making the wealthy pay something closer to their fair share, which Obama also mentioned in that speech, asking the wealthy to pay just a little bit more because they can afford to. But you know, help us understand, there's been a real gulf between the Washington conversation and what Americans want when asked. How have we gotten to a point where that gulf has shrunk?
So there's so many people involved in this that I am going to just continually use the royal we. But if you ever ask me for a comma separated list of organizations and activists, it would be 30 minutes long because of what you said, because of the extreme popularity. That initial setup where I said, I look at it somewhat as two islands. And in the beginning, there really weren't that many people on this expansion island. And there were... It was not as lonely on the quote-unquote bipartisan solution island, which is where the cuts lived. And that consensus, though, that bipartisan consensus that sort of existed, it only existed in Washington, D.C. Only in D.C., well, the greedy liars on Wall Street and their minions in D.C.
Casey, ring the bell.
No, I was going to say ding, ding, ding. Yep. Yeah.
That's where that consensus was. And everywhere else in the country, there was the exact opposite consensus. You could actually ask a Tea Party household and a union-led household, a Democrat, Republican, Independent, it did not matter. And they had a bipartisan consensus against all cuts. And then as we moved it and actually just asked the question, what do you think about expanding it and paying for that by asking millionaires and billionaires to pay the same rate? You find bipartisan consensus around that idea. So what we had to do was actually it made it very easy in one respect, because all we had to do was play this sort of translational role. We had to take what was happening in D.C. and bring it out and be like, hey, do you folks know what they're trying to do right now? When they say this, when they say chain CPI, that means reaching into your pocket and stealing your earned benefits. When they say this, right, they're talking about cuts. And then it's less translational because it was just a hell no back to D.C., but it was taking the voice of millions of Americans back into D.C. and making it incredibly difficult for anybody who wanted to propose cuts or make that move in D.C. to have that happen.
So I think everyone in this room can probably agree that it's often hard to create progressive coalitions where we all agree on what the solution has to be. And before we started taping, you were talking about how it was just expansion alone. Just that phrase is what really helped us to get to this point. Can you explain what you meant by that?
And also, like, give us a little bit of the origin story here, right? I mean, I think it's useful because, you know, as we have conversations about how do we get to a point where we're not just having a conversation about how much do we cut and we want to shift that Overton window, the Social Security expansion movement really does potentially offer a model or a lesson for how we might be able to do that more broadly. How did we get here? What's the origin story?
The first thing is, I'll try to keep the venom to a modest amount, but the media are literally the worst ever. And they were...
Except small, more independent media like us.
The corporate media.
Yes.
The corporate media were the worst. But this is part of the solution is you, is this studio right here. I saw early on that we needed to tell our own story. That if you left it to the TV, they were going to actually lie about what was going on. They were going to always allow the greedy liars on Wall Street's minions.
Ding, ding.
To put their talking points out to scare the people and to confuse people. So first, you had to build up, you know, a network of people who cared about the issue. And with Social Security, that's actually pretty easy to do. But work in authentic partnerships with, you know, labor, seniors organizations, women's organizations, the Netroots, and all of these different groups. In the beginning, it was the Bowles-Simpson Commission, the BS Commission. So having this common enemy. And then the BS report that they put out. And we had to fight against all of this BS, just a constant stream of billionaire-funded BS. And we beat it. We actually defeated it multiple times. And that built a lot of, camaraderie. I think more important than optimism was actually that we were working in good faith with each other, mm-hmm. that these organizations, that we had this ability to defeat the greedy liars on Wall Street.
Ding.
But
we're going to keep doing that.
And I'll keep doing it, too.
We know you will.
And that was important so that people knew that we were acting in good faith and that we were focused on this. But at a point, it became very much like playing whack-a-mole, right? I mean, we would defeat one policy and it would pop up the same exact thing with different language. And then we'd smash that down. And then... and this is a long 6-year story, so I'm skipping some stuff. We fight BS for a while. We beat billionaire funded BS. But then you remember the fiscal cliff? And that was actually like the culmination of BS. That actually started at the Bowles-Simpson Commission, the ridiculous turn towards austerity. And at the fiscal cliff, it was really, really apparent that there was not at all a valid negotiating partner on the other side of the table, that you had these political arsonists who were going to take any compromise that was offered. They were going to pocket it. And that would be the new starting point of the next crisis that they fomented. So the progressive movement, all these groups, organizations, and activists who, again, had fought and won together, said, we're not going to actually wait for them to throw something at us and then fight that thing. We're not going to wait for the mole to come up. We're going to take the machine and we're going to smash it to pieces with a sledgehammer, rhetorically. by...
We don't promote violence on this show.
By... drawing a line in the sand against any and all cuts. And we actually had a literal meeting where we defined, what does that mean? Oh, that means decreasing a person's income or increasing their costs. And then we had a vote in this room where it was a thumbs up, thumbs down, thumbs sideways for no vote. It was a unanimous thumbs up. And everyone agreed, here is what we're going to do. Line in the sand. We are not going to accept any cuts, no matter what is in the other side, right? They can offer anything. You know, we're going to take all of Pete Peterson's money if you just let us cut one penny from one person's benefits. No.
Because it's a slippery slope, right? Mm-hmm. By drawing that line, it says this is unacceptable. You can't cross this line. We are going to hold you accountable.
Right. This is a moral understanding of the issue here. So that actually led directly into when we delivered 2 million petitions to the White House, who actually had the chain CPI cut in their budget. This is around 2012. They pulled it out of their budget, which is, again, a huge thing that usually does not happen. If it's in the budget, it stays there and is then becomes a zombie thing over and over. So at that point, again, I'll make fun of the left a little bit. Hippies have this tendency, if they knock their opponent down, they're like, oh, no. And then they try to help them up. And that's not at all how you fight against greedy liars from Wall Street.
Ding. But it's a wonderful sentiment in someone's heart, but not a good political strategy.
And not when what they're trying to do is literally reach into millions of people's pockets, steal their money, and push people into poverty. So what we
also offers a nice kind of the diversity of the types of game-based analogies. We have whack-a-mole, but now I'm also picturing, you know, the one with the clown, where the clown, like, you hit him,
you knock
and,
it,
like, comes
and it comes
right back up, right? I feel like that's, except that in this one, you're helping the clown.
Well, it's like the claw machine with the arcade. So, yeah, they
you
just keep
trying
to
never works
up?
For me? Well, like, literally going back to childhood, I have so many horrible, sad, disappointed memories of putting money into that machine, and, like, the claw goes down, and did it work for anybody else? Was anyone else ever able to come away with
joy? Well, I was born in Berkeley, so with this analogy, if the claw is a hippie, it did work for me.
Within the claw was it?
But anyway, back to Alex.
Or you came up with a hippie in your claw.
Yeah. We just derailed you. I'm sorry, Alex.
Sorry, Alex.
No, that was wonderful.
So that is not the proper strategy.
It's
wonderful to have sympathy for your fellow man, but when they're greedy liars on Wall Street,
ding.
Get my own ding, they're not the group to have the sympathy for.
And what we're doing is we're fighting a real battle that affects millions of people. And we have a moral conviction and understanding of what is the just path here. Well, and then strategically.
Can I jump in here just because I want to say, hearing you tell this part of the origin story, and I know there's a lot more, right? And Tracy, before we started this segment, we wondered if Alex was going to have 30 minutes worth of things to say. Why would we ever ask that question? It's Alex. But I feel like actually just a couple of days ago, Senator Orrin Hatch gave a speech on the floor where he actually named you guys. Mm-hmm. And what he did was he called you out for intransigence. agents that you just won't give at all, and you're so unreasonable because you said no cuts at all, and in fact, the only thing you'll accept is expansion. So you guys really are intransigent, but now we're hearing why.
And I didn't take that as an insult.
I was about to say, did you reply, thank you?
No, we
framed the speech on his wall, actually.
And then we put it in an email and raised money off of it. So if you're listening, Senator, another floor speech is well appreciated. Keep us in business here, fighting the greedy liars on Wall Street.
Ding.
So here's what happens, and this is, I think, there's a lot of like story in this, changing the narrative. But here's the key strategic point: we went from being on defense to drawing the line in the sand, and then we're like, but you know what? What's way better is to be on offense. Let's actually fight for what we want. Let's fight to expand benefits, because the problem is this retirement security that millions of Americans are not going to be able to maintain their standard of living in retirement. What do we want to accomplish? We need to increase benefits.
And so that gets to the question I had about this 30-minute long list of organizations that you have that's working on this. How do you get them all to agree to fight for the same thing?
It's very difficult, except you have to have a...
Alex is very good at his job.
Patience is important, because factionalism will bring down any movement, right? And the way you fight back against that is, what is our goal? Not what is the path to get there, but where are we trying to go? And if that's where we're trying to go, and we all agree that that's where we're trying to go, to expand benefits, to increase benefits, let's all be okay with any way, any path that people come up with that actually gets there. We said that counts. So when we all group, we had another meeting of people, thumbs up, thumbs down, thumbs sideways vote, with the shared strategy. And the important thing, there were literally two bills at that time, and there were two groups that were kind of coalescing around two different bills, and they were ready to duke it out, the Begich bill and the Harkin bill. And the main accomplishment of the meeting, and this is why I brought up that goodwill before and the camaraderie and the having fought and trust that people are actually fighting together,
right?
It made it possible for us to say, what about we like both the bills? What about we actually like the concept of expansion? And that is what we're going to coalesce around. That's what we're going to fight for. And that is what got the thumbs up. That was 2013 at Netroots Nation. And that shared strategy from then till now, you know, my island that I started on in the beginning, there weren't many of us there. Now you have 95% of the Democrats in the Senate, 75% of the Democrats in the House, 100% of Democrats running for president, and the Democratic president. That is the only island anymore. And you know, the billionaire-funded minions in D.C. are alone on their little island, being like, no, but we wanted to steal people's money.
So now that we have the kind of the last holdout being Obama to make this speech and mention expansion, what is the path forward now that it's a mainstream position? You know, how far are, you know, you and other advocates hoping that the Democratic Party will push for?
I think there's a couple parts to that answer. One is, for the first time in far too long in this election, there's going to be a really clear choice. There's going to be a very easy choice for voters. They're going to say the Democrats are the party that fight to expand Social Security. The Republicans are the party that fight to cut Social Security. And there's going to be...
Can I jump in there for just 1 second? Because I think it's more complicated than that, right? So actually, what we saw on the Republican side of the aisle this year in you know, 100% of people running for president again, right? How many people could they fit in the clown car? Was that actually there were lots of candidates who wanted to cut Social Security, but then the one who emerged was actually the one who said, the one who emerged as the nominee, was the one who said no cuts to Social Security. Now, unclear what, you know, whether that's going to remain, right? And without getting
all indications say no. His policy advisor already went before the billionaire class and said no.
But does that itself not also reflect a shift in the Overton window, that it's not even just Republicans or the party of cut, but rather that actually in perhaps being slightly less tone deaf to what the American people want, we actually have a nominee who might say no cuts on the Republican side of the aisle. And so the choice might even be, although we don't know and probably not the case, but just still interesting to me that even was in the mix and perhaps an indication of that shift.
And even then, the choice is still stark between expansion and no expansion, because Donald Trump has come out forcefully against expanding benefits. But I do think I was actually speaking with a reporter 2 days ago who I think got scooped by the president, unless they got a heads up. But they were trying to tell this whole story, and they kept wanting me to tell them people I disagreed with. Like, well, tell me someone on the left who you butted heads with. And I was like, that's a boring story that they're trying to write. And what I kept saying, and it is completely true, is that it doesn't matter. We didn't actually spend an enormous amount of time being like, oh, you're wrong on this. I mean, I did. We sent them our papers and we're like, you are wrong on this. You're on the wrong side. You should get on the right side. But what we did that was far more impactful, we put people on notice and let them know, but then we moved the entire landscape under their feet. We made it really untenable for them to remain in the wrong place. And that is shifting the Overton window, the people who get to decide the limits of the debate, that's power. Chomsky said that the best way to control people is to limit the distance in the debate, but then encourage vigorous debates within that section.
In those 3 inches that you've given them.
And then let them duke it out, punch each other in the face. But really, the key is to move the edges of that. So that is what I think we did. We expanded the realm of what we could talk about. And as soon as we did that, it was kind of obvious. And once you do that, just as kind of a like what I think we want to do movement wide, is when you change the narrative like that, it's really powerful. It's hard to go against that, or it's hard to change it back. It's really somewhat like, once it's done and the story is told and being told, it's very difficult to get people to like forget about that. Forget about the concept of expanding Social Security. They're not going to.
My mom was an adamant or ardent subscriber to the Chomsky theory when it came to me in childhood. It didn't work necessarily, but like she would say, you're going to get dressed in the morning. It wasn't like, what are you going to wear? Do you want to wear pants? It was, which of these two pairs of pants do you want to wear? Because I might have chosen no pants. I might have said
That's
no.
That's still a battle she has. No.
I might have said no. Right. But so fast forward to present day. Right. So now we're in a position where, as you said, we actually have the president being amazingly a lagging indicator of how far we've come, because it was just, a couple of years ago where the idea of Social Security expansion was something that got described as fringy. Mm-hmm. Right. It was that crazy idea. Right. Oh, man. Evidence of someone's being out of the mainstream. And now we're at a point where, as you said, it has become the consensus view of the Democratic Party.
And so the next thing is in the next Congress, we have an election. That's the actual next thing. But it's nice that there's a real choice this election. After that, we're going to pass legislation to expand Social Security. I don't know which one it is, and I don't know exactly what Congress is going to do it, but we're going to fight to do exactly that. And the American people are with us. And, you know, that is a force that is very difficult to stand against. So that is, I think, the next step. And at the same time, we are going to open up some other fronts in this battle. Like right now, we're focused a lot on drug prices because drug prices are too high. And with people's cost of living adjustments being zero this year, they get no more money, but their drug prices are going up 12%. That's a benefit cut going directly into the pockets of pharmaceutical executives. So I want to use the strength of the movement that's changed this narrative to take on things like high drug prices. And I also think, obviously, we want to expand it into discussions of Medicare. We want to lower the Medicare age. You know, we want to create a program like MediKids, 0 to 5. Move the age down to 62 and then just keep moving one age down and the other age up until we meet in the middle.
So one thing that's interesting about all of this is that there is a lot of momentum. There's this growing economic justice movement across the country, which makes it which should suggest that you can continue to propose ideas that would have once had you, you know, marooned on your own island. What are your thoughts on kind of incremental change versus these bigger, bolder ideas? Is there a place for both? Our producer, Alyssa, brought up the Fight for 15 movement, which I think a $15 minimum wage at a certain point seemed bizarre, but is now becoming a mainstream position. How do you deal, I guess, with the tension between incremental change seeming good on one hand, but this evidence that you have of going big or going home can actually work as well?
I learned a lot in the fight for Obamacare, actually, that I worked for Healthcare for America Now, on Healthcare for America Now, fighting for Obamacare. And what one of the main lessons I took from that to the Social Security fight is that it is actually not the jobs of activists, advocates of the community to compromise. We don't have to follow in behind the compromise. What we have to do is be clear and clarion in our call for justice, for what it is that we want. We want a $15 minimum wage. Oh, but that's not reasonable. Well, that's somebody else's business, not mine. We want a $15 minimum wage because even that's not keeping up with prices, right? Like that role, and I'm at the same time acknowledging that there are different roles, right? So I think the community, I think Fight for 15 is the perfect example of what, you know, what you want to do. You want to call for what you want. You want to be bold and you want to, I mean, this is America we're talking about. America is a great nation that does great things when we are being our best selves. And that is the thing that we have to get back to. We've been doing this really disastrous focus on very small things, tiny little things, and pretending like we can't solve huge challenges. Of course we can solve huge challenges. How are we stymied by Zika virus right now? How is the House of Representatives just voting down, putting money to a public health crisis? This is what America should be doing. We are a great nation when we are being our best selves. And we are definitely a profoundly wealthy nation, the wealthiest nation in the world at the richest point in our history. So to pretend that we can't afford for the American people to have a retire in dignity or for working folks to actually make a wage that they can raise a family on. All of these economic justice, but also what I think are just profoundly common sense in American fights, they have this one great benefit as well. They're self-reinforcing, right? When we raise the wages for working Americans, that helps Social Security. When we raise the ability for people to retire with dignity, that helps the economy and allows for wages to go up. That is how America becomes and is great when we remember that it's our, when we focus on the people, when we focus on the people are what make America great.
Well, it's hard. I mean, since you bring all of that up, right, it's hard not to have this. It's hard to have this conversation without situating it more broadly in the fact that the Republican Party refuses to let go of trickle-down economics. Mm-hmm. And that's really what's at the core of basically their entire economic policy platform, which is what informs their desire to continue to find 3/5 of their cuts in budgets from low and moderate income programs so that they can slash taxes for the wealthy and for corporations. They don't do it, just because or under the auspices of wanting to help those people, right, and corporations. They do it because they say that's what's going to produce growth. And whether they believe that or not, it's what they continue to say, despite the fact that it's been shown not to be true.
Kansas.
Yes. I think that's exactly right. But what you bring up now, right, is the inverse of that, which it feels like there have been some progressive groups trying to have this conversation and to shift the conversation around to it. It isn't even just about people who are going to be helped and families who are going to be better off and workers who are going to be fairly paid. It's about how actually all of that ends up also improving the economy and expanding economic growth, which then becomes self-reinforcing
exactly.
as well, right? So, Alex?
And this is not a new thing in the final 30 seconds, I'm sure. That's what we have to remember and be leaders on, is not letting anyone tell the story that our side is like, this is a new idea. This is an old idea. The other side's idea are brand spanking new. That's from Reagan. That's very new. It's a 30-year experiment that's completely failed. We're trying to return to understood American values that when all of us do better, we all do better.
And next week we'll be talking more about this when we start to look at a progressive agenda to cut poverty and expand opportunity.
Alex Lawson, Executive Director of Social Security Works and strategic partner from We Act Radio. Thanks for coming.
And man whom we have to ding a lot about.
You've got us 24 hours a day on your mobile smartphone via the Progressive Voices app. This is the Progressive Voices channel on TuneIn.
Hi, I'm Gianna Garrel from Progressive Voices. Today, the angry roar of the conservative media machine dominates TV and radio, threatening to drown out and push out anyone who dares to discuss our progressive perspectives and ideals. But we can't let that happen. We have too many strong, smart, and important progressive voices who need to be heard. That's why here at PV, we're building a 21st century progressive media universe. One where all the best in progressive media can come together, rise above the static and the noise, and be heard by anyone, anywhere. And we need your help. We're in the middle of a critical campaign to make our dream of 21st century progressive media universe a reality. But we can't do it without grassroots support from people like you. Head over to progressivevoices.com to see how you can help. Please support this important progressive mission, because with your help, we can make sure all our progressive voices are heard.
You're listening to Talk Poverty Radio on the We Act Radio Network and the Progressive Voices Network. I'm Rebecca Vallis.
And I'm Tracy Ross, and we're joined by our friend Joe Valenti on the Econ team. Joe, what is your exact title?
I'm the Director of Consumer Finance on the Econ team.
You'll learn something new every day. I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's one of those things where I'm like, we're really good friends, but wait, who are you?
Joe Valenti? One of those V names.
Valenti. It's right next to yours in the alphabet.
So Joe, I'm gonna borrow from a Talk Poverty piece that you wrote this week. You open with an Elizabeth Warren quote, and then we can get into why you quote Elizabeth Warren and what we're talking about. You cite her in saying, in 2007, and this is when she was actually a professor, she was not yet in the Senate, Professor Elizabeth Warren reminded us that, quote, it is impossible to buy a toaster that has a 1 in 5 chance of bursting into flames and burning down your house. But it's entirely possible to buy a financial product with the same odds of causing financial ruin. And you note that payday and car title loans, which can come with annual interest rates of 300% or in some cases even more, really are kind of those toasters. So this has been a big week in your world. The CFPB, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, put out a proposed rule that would do a lot to take these kinds of harmful, predatory products off of the shelf for consumers. Tell us about the rule and why it's so needed.
So this is a big deal this week. As you said, the CFPB announced proposed rules on payday lending that we've been waiting for really for years. It's something that they've talked about doing ever since the Bureau opened its doors in 2011, and it's finally happened. So this Thursday in Kansas City, they released a proposal that would rein in a lot of the worst practices by predatory lenders who take from people who have trouble making ends meet. They offer to solve your problems, and then they end up digging you into an even deeper financial hole.
So to back up a little bit, let's dive into this. So we had someone on a few weeks ago talking actually about the Google rule and how Google decided they're no longer going to advertise these payday lenders. But whether you're going online or going to a brick and mortar place, say I'm $400. I just need it quick because of childcare or an accident or anything that could happen. I go to a payday lender to fill that gap. And then I get presented with a 300% interest rate. What exactly happens? Where do people get caught in the trap where they're not able to pay off that $400 loan?
So here's what happens. You either get pop-up ads online, which is why the Google action is so significant, or you see bright neon lights in your neighborhood that, hey, fast cash now. And you walk in and they will say, okay, you need $400, so you get paid in 2 weeks. In 2 weeks, you'll give us $400 plus a fee. Let's say it's $50.
Which kind of on its face value might sound reasonable. Mm-hmm. I'll be paid in a couple weeks. I'll pay this loan off quickly.
Right. Or some people go to a car title lender, and in that case, you say, hey, here's my car title. Here's a spare set of keys. I'll pay you back within the next month or so, and if I don't, you can take my car. And people will actually do this if they feel like they're in a financial pinch. The problem is if you don't have $400 right now, you probably don't have $450 in 2 weeks. And if you're someone who's constantly living paycheck to paycheck, you take out one of these loans, you're not likely to be able to pay it back, especially with all of the fees and penalties that get assigned. So you walk back in 2 weeks later and you say, hey, I'm sorry, I don't have the $450. And they'll say, that's okay, give us $50. And then you can pay us in 2 weeks, and it ends up rolling over. So this happens for about 4 out of 5 payday loan borrowers. They can't pay it off immediately. It just keeps on rolling over. It's more fees. It's more interest. Before you know it, the typical payday loan borrower is taking 7 or more loans during the year instead of just the one loan that was supposed to get you out of your trouble.
So in 4 out of 5 cases, the person who is taking out this loan that they probably had every intention or every thought that they were only going to need that one loan, they're rolling it over or they're renewing it. Am I getting that right?
Exactly. Exactly.
So that's how people end up sort of trapped in this cycle. So help us understand, though, what an annual interest rate of 300% really means. How much does someone end up paying for something like this $400 loan?
So it ends up being that you'll end up, if you end up rolling it over and over and over again, you're going to be paying probably more in interest and fees than the actual loan amount that you took out. And lenders will tell you, oh, it's not really a big deal because you're going to pay it back in the next installment. And so it's really not such a high rate. But we know that for 4 out of 5 borrowers, that's not the case. It also is, you know, at 300%, that's 20 times the annual interest rate on a typical credit card. That's, you know, 100 times some of the rates that are offered on mortgages and car loans that people who are in decent financial situations can take advantage of. So it's just a ridiculous disparity in what people are charged.
And
it's setting them up to fail.
You cite an example in the piece that you wrote that's on talkpoverty.org right now. You cite the St. Louis resident, Naya Burks, who just took out a $1,000 loan and it became $40,000 worth of debt. So this jumps up to be a life-crushing amount of money that they're starting to have to live, essentially, bound to this loan.
Absolutely. In her case, it was not just that she wasn't able to keep up with the payments, but that ultimately, you know, the interest and fees build up, and the lender tried to sue her for what she owed. And you would think, hey, you know, I took out a loan, I can't pay it back, I get sued. Okay, maybe it's not $1,000, maybe it's $2,000, $3,000. You don't think it's going to grow to $40,000. And it was only when a reporter found her case and asked the lender, hey, what's going on here? The lender was like, oh, we'll drop that. And that one was let go. But there are cases that we hear from all over the country, whether it's from legal aid lawyers, from consumer advocates, from pastors and rabbis, and that people end up in financial trouble, and the thing that got them into this mess isn't really what they're dealing with now. They're dealing with a much deeper hole, and they would have been better off if they had found a way to avoid the loan in the first place.
So they were looking for a lifeline, and they got handed a shovel.
Exactly. It's a leaky life vest.
We could, how many more can we do?
I was like, should I throw one more
you
in
know,
there?
It's a weighted anchor. There were about 300 analogies that came up during the CFPB's hearing on this rule this week. And it's, you know, it's everything you can think of. It's poisoned food.
So I'm interrupting you, Tracy. I have a question about poisoned food. Sorry. So I have to ask, though, playing devil's advocate for a second, right? there was a piece in The Atlantic that sort of went viral last month about how nearly half of Americans report that they don't even have $400 in savings. And you've done a lot of work on how economic insecurity has really translated into widespread lack of savings. And this is not something that's restricted to people who are considered to be low income or even poor. We're talking about, you know, wide shares of the American public at this point. Aren't payday lenders, some might say, and so I'll play devil's advocate and say this, just filling a really important need for people who don't have access to other forms of credit?
Not really. It's a market that's grown up expecting that people are going to be hungry and giving them poisoned food to solve their problems. And it's a market that's really only grown in the past 20 to 30 years as we've seen income stagnate and people have had more and more trouble getting ends meet, that we end up looking to credit. And for some people, it's credit cards. And for some, it's payday loans to think that we can tide things over.
And so what is an option for a low-income person then if these payday lenders aren't filling that gap? Where can they turn to?
So sometimes it's credit. And there are some banks and credit unions that are doing affordable loans, responsible loans. One of the big things is that they generally will try to figure out what you can afford before making you the loan, which seems like common sense, right? But when you're a predatory lender, you're not actually interested in somebody paying you back. You're interested in collecting interest and fees over and over and over again.
Because you're predatory.
Right.
You're praying. That's what you do.
Exactly. So some of them are financial. And I do think that, you know, if we have a strong rule that moves forward and we can kick out some of the bad actors, we're going to see some better financial opportunities to help people in their credit crunch. Because if I'm thinking about making loans to people and the predator across the street is charging 300% interest and making money off of that, I can't compete with that if I want to be sort of a reasonable financial actor. But if we only think about it as credit, we miss the point, because a lot of times the answers are not credit. And they never have been. Sometimes it's hard decisions. Sometimes it's paying other bills late. Sometimes it's, moving in with friends and family or getting financial support from them. Often it's really about the safety net that we talk so much on this show about how frayed it is and how people can't get the lifelines that they need. That it's really not a credit problem. And I'd even go one step further. And one way I like to look at this is even your favorite bartender, who you know and love and you hang out with on a regular basis, may cut you off at some point. If it's really not good for you and you've had too much and you're in a really bad spot and, you know, trust me and you'll thank me in the morning that I cut you off. These lenders typically aren't doing that, because their business model is based on getting you to come in again and again and again.
So is the new slogan for, because it used to be stop the debt trap, are we moving to not your favorite bartender? Is that the message we want people? Since you brought up car title loans, I also just don't want to lose that thread, because that's been an important kind of emerging evil within this movement, right? Is that, and particularly in states, I think I'm getting this right, in states where state policymakers have actually cracked down to some extent on payday products, the industry has found other ways to pop up, right? And one of those other types of products that has emerged to get around those new regulations in some states has been auto title loans. Tell us a little bit about how that works and how that turns out for the borrowers.
Absolutely. And Arizona is the perfect example. Arizonans had a temporary payday loan law in the 2000s. They said, hey, let's try this out. Let's see how it works. And it turned out that people were really unhappy about it. And they even went to the polls and they got outspent horrifically in a ballot initiative, and the people against payday loans still won. So what the lenders decided to do was they're starting to make these title loans. So typically, you hand over your car title or a set of keys. In Arizona, it's not even your title, it's just your registration. You may not have even paid off the car. You may not fully own the car, but you give them your registration. And again, that's just part of the loophole system that these actors prey off of. And typically, you know, 4 out of 5 borrowers, again, can't keep up with payments and they end up reborrowing. But about 1 in 5 ultimately lose the car. That one day you just get the the tow truck and the repo man and the flashing lights, and your car's gone. And here's the thing that was getting you to work. It was getting your kids to daycare. It was your entire livelihood that was on the line, and now it's gone. And
it's the textbook example of
so much worse than before.
Yeah. Right, because, you know, there's plenty of data that shows that access to having a, access to having a car increases your chances for employment. There's, especially if you're in a place like Arizona, where you're not going to have a dependable public transit system to rely on. If we're using more, you know, examples like Arizona or other places that are rural, this is huge. This is something that these families aren't going to gamble on a car lightly. This is clearly they're in dire straits, and now they're in a worse position.
Right, and I like the car title example because it goes back to this whole toaster thing, that it's 1 in 5 toasters exploding is something that we would never permit as a society. 1 in 5 borrowers losing the car is pretty bad too, and yet because it's something that's financial, we don't look at it in the same way that we look at other sort of ripoffs and consumer protection problems.
So Joe, what does this rule, back to the rule, what does this rule that was released this week from the CFPB on these issues, what is it actually going to do? How is it going to protect people? Is it what we've needed?
It's absolutely what we've needed, and like I said, it's a long time coming. We lose $8 billion a year in interest and fees to payday and auto title loans.
Who's we in that? The people who are actually getting
the
loans?
We as the borrowers.
Oh,
yep.
Okay.
And that's not even counting the indirect costs on their families and communities when they get stuck in a debt trap and they have to get bailed out anyway. Mm-hmm. When maybe if they had looked for help from other sources in the beginning, they would have been able to avoid this whole mess. So you you have folks losing $8 billion a year. And the number one thing the CFPB is doing is that for most loans under the rule, you actually would need to demonstrate that you're able to pay back the loan. So the bank or the payday lender or whomever it is has to check your income, has to check your expenses, and actually be comfortable with you being able to meet the payments. Which again is common sense. It's
it sounds common sense, but not
that it's not the law right now. And that's a problem. And we saw that leading up to the foreclosure crisis, right? You had people who didn't have a lot of money, but a lender could claim that you could buy a $1 million house, and everybody signs the dotted line and acts like it's okay. You know, being able to document income and expenses, making sure that you can pay all of your other bills, because yeah, maybe you can come up with that $450 in 2 weeks. But at the expense of your rent or food or utilities or other things, making sure that this is a loan that actually fits in your budget. So that's a big part of it. Another part of it is making sure that the lender doesn't just keep pickpocketing money out of your bank account. So there was someone who testified at the CFPB hearing this week who talked about a borrower whose bank account got tapped 15 times. To try to pay off the loan when it came due.
Explain what that means. What do you mean that her bank account got tapped?
So typically, when you take out the loan, you will authorize the lender to take the money out of your bank account in 2 weeks after you get paid. So it's, you know, hey, so in after I get paid, I'll be fine. I know it's $450. You can take it out of my bank account. They'll request that authorization. And at the time, it seems like, well, that's a no-brainer. I'm going to get paid anyway. But it turns out that for a lot of people, they have other bills that take priority or something can come up between now and then, and they'll dip into your bank account anyway, to the point where for people who get their payday loans on the internet, nearly 1 in 4 end up losing their bank account because it gets closed either by them or by the bank from all of these pulls trying to take money out to
Because imagine there's like overdrafts and that
right,
sort of
exactly.
thing, right? Because they
exactly.
don't have fully have enough money to pay
right.
it back.
So a big part of the rule is saying that your account only can get tapped twice to try to pay off the loan. And if it's unsuccessful after that, they can't go after you again without your permission. And they would actually have to reach out to you and explain, because this is something, I mean, it's confusing. Most of us don't understand how a lot of these things work behind the scenes. And if you just wake up in the morning, you check your bank balance and your money's gone, or you get hit with a bunch of fees, how are you going to deal with that?
And so this all seems like a no-brainer to me that we need rules to rein this in. You've laid out all the points. You've laid out how deeply into debt people have been trapped. This is such a horrible example of people preying on low-income people. But members of Congress have been trying to push back on these rules all along the way, and they're still trying to hinder CFPB's ability to act independently. What are their justifications of essentially trying to still uphold this system?
So part of it is this argument about access and choice, which frankly comes up every time you see people getting ripped off.
Unbelievable, right? I love it. It's a situation
where they're never
pro-choice
when it matters.
Right.
That was the better line. Tracy had the better line. I was going to say it's a situation of that is classic exploitation of people who have no options, right, and are desperate. And to refer to this as choice is really amazing.
We see it. You know, I work on a lot of different financial issues, and we see it across the board.
Because you're the director of consumer finance,
we learned today.
So it's your choice to go to a for-profit college, where we just learned this week that typically graduates end up with more debt and lower incomes than they did when they enrolled in that school. It's your choice to make any number of decisions that are just brutally awful and that don't help you. And some people have compared this to, well, if, you know, it sounds like you're trying to take all the cars off the road because cars can be dangerous. And when, yes, we took the Ford Pinto
and the Chevy Corvair.
We took cars off the road for, you know, we mandated seatbelts. We've done all of these things because
it saved lives.
Right, guess what? We're going to save lives. We've got problems. So part of it is this whole mantra about access and choice. Some people would say that it's, you know, if I want to eat barbecue every day of my life, why are you getting in the way?
If I want to buy Hot Pockets from the grocery store with E. coli in them, I want to have that option, right?
Right. So part of it gets in this sort of access and choice thing.
Don't
part
sue
of
us, Hot Pockets. Hot Pockets are healthy as far as we know. We don't have E. coli.
Was there a report? Come on, it happened.
I don't pay. I've just been paying attention to Chipotle.
Time of the horse meat.
Okay, everybody Google your food. Be careful. Sorry.
Ongoing recall. No. Sorry, okay. This was a thing. It happened. Okay. I'm sure Hot Pockets are fine now.
I don't want to get scared. Check it out.
They
guys.
Might not
we don't
be
know.
Okay.
Check it for yourself.
Whether they're okay or not, guess what? We've got the FDA. We've got health departments.
Thanks for taking us back.
We've got people keep an eye on it.
So keeping us on task. Thank you.
The other part of this is, frankly, some of it just comes down to money and politics. If you think about I mentioned Arizona before. In Arizona, the lenders and their lobbyists spent about $15 million over 6 years just on this one issue. And if you look at what gets spent around the country and the way that money ends up talking in our political system, you know, it can be corrupting. And part of that is you'll hear these access arguments come from some folks who are claiming to represent the needs of low-income people who may not necessarily have those interests at heart. I mean, let's be clear. I'm sure you can find a success story out there. The House Financial Services Committee last month found a returning citizen who started a business with payday loans, and it seems to be doing pretty well.
And I'm sure is the poster child.
Is Paul Ryan going to create a documentary with him at some point? I'm sure,
probably.
Right?
But you end up with this money and politics thing. You end up with the state sovereignty thing. I don't know if you guys saw everything about Florida and how I wrote for Duck Poverty a few months ago about how some folks in Florida were saying, hey, we're the model for the country. We've got this right. We've got this under control. Don't mess with us. Just leave us be. Payday lenders are taking $76 million a year out of Florida families. Florida is not the model here. But you get some folks who think, oh, maybe we're doing this okay when there are national models. There are 14 states. It's mostly in the Northeast, but some are in other parts of the country, as well as the District of Columbia that have said, look, 36% annual interest is as high as is reasonable. Some states even set a little bit lower. Congress itself said in 2007, that's good enough for our service members and their families, because we know that predatory loans harm our troops. And that was something that was signed into law by President George W. Bush. So we've recognized that atrocious, rapacious interest rates have no place in our society. And yet, a lot of states still let this happen, and states are going to play a huge role as this rule unfolds, because thanks to a little provision in Dodd-Frank, the law that created the CFPB can't set a limit on interest rates. So it's up to states to take that next step and make sure that they're going to look after their own residents and make sure that, you know, nobody's getting stuck in a cycle of debt with a 300% loan.
Well, and to that point, since you're talking about states, and we were talking a little bit earlier about how some states have actually taken action, and there are some model states when it comes to the policies that they have on the books, not Arizona, it would sound like.
But they get props for trying.
They get props for trying.
But okay. it just hasn't worked out.
Okay, well, so go forth and keep be strong, going, Arizona. We've got you. We want to have you on the show to talk about success. But how does the state legal framework come into play if this rule gets finalized? Say a state has a great law on the books and it's actually more ambitious and more protective than what is in this CFPB policy. How do we square those two?
So a state like New York or Pennsylvania that does have a good law on the books will be able to work hand in hand with the CFPB. The CFPB has made clear that it encourages tough state laws. We have to remember the director of the CFPB comes from Ohio, and Ohio is another state where the voters chose to ban payday lending, and the lenders just found another loophole. And the next day they decided, no, we're not payday lenders anymore, we're mortgage lenders. And that got upheld in the courts. But going back to...
I'm picturing them like putting on like Groucho Marx glasses with the little mustache attached. And they're like, no, I'm somebody new now.
Right. You don't remember me. I'm something different. And that's the biggest challenge here. It's a whack-a-mole problem that you have.
Whack-a-mole in today's show, Tracy.
You know, or they're chameleons. You find a loophole here. That's how this whole title versus registration thing came up in Arizona. It's crazy. But states that have good laws on the books should try to keep them around. The hard part is they're going to be faced with these lobbyists who come in and say, hey, there's a new federal standard. Your laws are, you know, 30, 40, in some states, these laws are close to 100 years old that said that you can't charge exorbitant interest rates. Some of these types of laws go back to the founding of our country. But the lobbyists will say, oh, your laws are outdated. There's this new federal standard. The CFPB has it. Why don't you just follow what they're doing?
Gosh.
And
sounds
then
all nice
you end
and,
up opening
and warm and fuzzy
the door, right? And why wouldn't we all want to have similar laws under a federal standard, right? But that can go either way. Either you have a really good federal standard or you've got a sort of Swiss cheese standard and then you've got all of these loopholes that open up. So it's a very different game in states that already have good laws on the books and need to keep them, and other states, and it's Missouri, it's Louisiana, it's really close to 36 states that have dealt with this in some form, and where the legislature has really struggled to move on the issue, where the CFPB's action is a great gift, it's a great help. It's another case of the federal government stepping in when a state is unable or unwilling to do right by its people. But they still have their own work to do if they want to curb the rapacious interest rates and really do what they can to protect borrowers. I mean, half the problem here is the laws on the books, and half the problem is enforcing the strong laws that different states have.
Also, just how infrequently the word rapacious is used. Now that you've used it twice, we need to bring it back. Rapacious, it needs to be in common usage.
It's rapacious, it's exploitative, it's
well, that one gets time in
the
sun.
What's going to be done to counteract, I guess, these predatory lobbyists that are trying to trick these states into rolling back their good protections?
Well, that's a good question. I think it's going to take a lot of organizing at the state level. And that's one thing I've been really impressed by is how many different groups of people have been standing up for these rules because they've seen it firsthand. And it's your usual consumer advocate types like me, but you also get attorneys, you get civil rights folks, you get faith leaders who have been an enormous piece of this movement. And it really doesn't matter. You've got folks from, you know, different denominations of Christianity and Judaism and other faiths that all have banded together and said, hey, this is a problem that's affecting our people and you need to be paying attention. So I think part of it is the organizing. And part of it is making sure the CFPB can finalize the strongest rule possible. So there's a 90-day comment period, and it will go until, I believe, it's September 14th. And there is actually a website, stoppaydaypredators.org, where there are standard sample letters that you can use to take action and contact the CFPB and let them know that this is something that you're concerned about and that they should move forward with the toughest thing that they can.
And I'm looking at the website now, stoppaydaypredators.org, and it has all sorts of lovely flashing lights. It looks like I'm actually looking at a payday lending shop. Fun to look at, not just to submit a comment if you're bored at work today.
But Joe Valenti, Director of Consumer Finance here at CAP, thank you so much for joining and walking us through this, and we'll have to have you back.
Absolutely. Happy to do it.
And that's our show. Thanks for listening to Talk Poverty Radio, broadcasting from the heart of Anacostia in Washington, D.C. You can catch us weekends at 11 a.m. on the We Act Radio Network. You can also catch us Saturdays, 11 a.m., and Sundays at 10 a.m. on the Progressive Voices Network via the TuneIn app.
You can also subscribe to Talk Poverty Radio as a podcast via iTunes. And feel free to pitch us on Twitter at the handle @TalkPoverty or email us at info@talkpoverty.org. See you next week.